extra lecture by Dan Harlow on RT and quantum error correction.
Yeah, sounds good. All right, yeah, so yeah, I guess I was just volunteered to give this talk. The verbs were correct there, yesterday. So yeah, it's gonna be about a paper I put out last week. So for the students, this may go a bit fast because I'm doing it more as a research seminar, but actually some of this stuff I'll discuss in more detail in my lecture Friday next week. So somehow things are sort of acausal. But if it's confusing, you will hear at least the first part of it again. So sorry that the fast time came first. All right. So ADS-CFT, something that we hear a lot about in this workshop and in general. It's our best theory of quantum gravity at the moment. Many aspects of it, of course, have been understood for a long time. Using the standard methods of conformal field theory that Tom was introducing some of this morning. But there are two features, well, really, let's say three features, but I'll mostly talk about the second two, of the correspondence, which, from the CFT point of view, I, at least, found kind of surprising. So the first one is radial commutativity. It's a long word. So that's saying like, here's ADS, this is a slice through the bulk, here's the boundary. So for bulk operators that are near the boundary, like this one or that one, they commute at space-like separation, and that just follows from the locality of the boundary CFT. But if you have a bulk operator in the center, well, that's also space-like separated, like say from this one. But that's not so obvious in the CFT, right? So this is the sort of question of how the radial direction emerges in the CFT. So that's one thing that's a little bit weird, or at least maybe surprising. Certainly the first time you heard about the correspondence, that's probably the thing you were surprised about. So another surprising feature of the correspondence is called subregion duality. So that's the statement that, if I give you access to only part of the boundary theory, so say this region A here, and then here's its complement over here, which you don't have access to, then there's a subregion in the bulk, which is bounded by this Ryu-Takinagi surface, where, well, if I have an operator, phi of x in here, there exists, I'll try not to write this, let me write it over here. Then there exists an operator phi a of x on the CFT Hilbert space, but actually with support only on the degrees of freedom here in A, which acts in the Hilbert space of the CFT like this bulk operator. So if you like, this subregion of the boundary is dual to this subregion of the bulk, right? So any bulk operator here can be represented in the CFT just as an operator here. And it's true in the complementary region too. So if we have some phi of y over here, then you can represent it as an operator in the CFT with support only there. That's also a little bit funny. And you can emphasize the extent to which it's funny by considering this situation, which probably a lot of you heard me talk about before, where we have three regions. And we think about the field here. This is an operator which can't be represented in A because it's not in this region, and can't be represented in B or in C because it's not in this region or that region. But it can be represented on any two of the boundary regions, right? So now there's a phi AB or phi BC or phi AC, but there isn't a phi A, a phi B, or a phi C. So where's the information, right? You know, it's kind of redundant, it's sort of multiply encoded somehow, either here, not here, not here, not here, but somehow in the union of any two. So that's, you know, from the CFT point of view, maybe that's a little surprising. And then the final feature, which is going to be the star of the show today, is the Rutaki-Nagi formula. So this says that, well, again, in this kind of situation here, so we have some boundary subregion A, and here's this Rutaki-Nagi surface gamma A, here's A bar. And then, well, we should give names to these bulk regions. So this one here we'll call the entanglement wedge of A, and then the complement over here we'll call the entanglement wedge of A bar. And then the Rutaki-Nagi formula says that, well, for states rho, so some, you know, we're given some quantum state in the CFT. If we compute S of rho A, several people, but for example, Horacio was discussing, we take the state rho and we take the partial trace over A bar to just get the state on A. So that's a nice CFT thing that we can compute. Well, what Ru and Takinagi told us is that this should be equal in the bulk to the expectation value of an operator I'll call L sub A plus the bulk entanglement entropy, or the bulk von Neumann entropy in this region here, the entanglement wedge of A. And just for simplicity, I'm calling this Rutaki-Nagi, but this is really sort of a generalization of Rutaki-Nagi, which is due to Faulkner, Lukacs, and Maldacena. But I'm just going to call it the Rutaki-Nagi formula, because otherwise things are going to get too confusing. So then this L sub A is an operator which is the area of gamma A over 4G plus corrections. But the corrections are still localized on this surface here. So there's a lot of people thinking about these corrections in general. I guess in particular, she has this beautiful formula for how to compute these corrections, at least for F of Riemann, theories of higher derivative gravity. And these corrections are always there, you know, because you know the bulk theory here is an effective field theory, and there are always higher dimension operators coming from strings and from Planck suppressed operators, at least, if nothing else. Okay, and then the same formula is going to be true also for the complementary region. So we'll have rho of A bar, trace of the same area operator, and now the bulk entropy in the entanglement wedge of A bar. When I first heard about this formula, I thought it was kind of funny. What are the states when it should be true, for example, is a question which is not totally obvious. You know, what if it's a superposition of, the vacuum and the solar system? You know, then is this formula true? Or, you know, and also, I mean, you know, in the original version of the formula, there wasn't this term here. And then it just looks obviously false, right? Because this thing is a linear functional of the state rho, right? But the entropy is a nonlinear functional of the state rho. So if we forget about this term, this is certainly not going to be true in any sort of, you know, linearly closed subspace of states in the Hilbert space. So when is it true? You know, how can it be true? And well, there are these corrections, so maybe it's something that's only true perturbatively anyway. So what I learned recently, though, is that this formula is actually quite general. And in fact, there's a nice mathematical theory of this formula, when it can be true. And in fact, it can be true exactly. So that maybe that's kind of going to be one of the main points of this talk, is that you can have a subspace of the Hilbert space where this equation is literally true, you know, with no corrections or anything. So you know, and I'll give you a simple example in a sec. So then, you know, then it, and somehow that really demystified it for me, right? Then it, you know, then it became a thing where, okay, now I kind of see what's going on here. This isn't so crazy as it seemed before. I mean, at least to me. You know? Now, of course, crazy doesn't mean wrong. I mean, it was obviously correct, just to be clear. I mean, you know, it's a tremendous accomplishment coming up with this formula. I just had my own sort of personal hang-ups with it, so which I've been working out and now working out with you together. Yeah, so the thing is the area operator here is shared between the two. So it's the same operator. Yeah. Okay. So the key point for resolving all three of these things is all three of these things are sort of naturally resolved once we decide that we're going to start thinking of the CFT as a quantum error correcting code. So for the first two, that was explained in a paper with Shi Dong, who is here somewhere, and Ahmed Almiri. And then we worked on it further with Fernando Pestovsky and Benny Yoshida and John Preskill. And then since then, there have been several more nice papers about this. There's a really nice one. I'm going to embarrass myself if I try to remember all the authors, but it's about random tensors. and it's really beautiful. I mean, you know, it's an amazing work of theoretical physics from the Stanford group. I think everyone is from Stanford, right? No, he's not here right now, but all the authors are from Stanford, right? So if I call it the Stanford group, then I'm not leaving anyone out. Okay. So the random tensor by the Stanford group is really, I think, the nicest illustration of these ideas in a concrete setting where you can compute everything. Okay, but this third one also was discussed in my paper with Fernando, Benny, and John, and then sort of discussed better by the Stanford people. But you know, just in the context of these examples, and I felt like it still didn't quite convey to me to what extent this really should be expected to be true or not. You know, in more general situations. But before I explain the sort of general theory of this, which I seem to have come up with, let's first discuss an example, just so we can all be on board with what all the symbols mean and so on. Okay. So example. So the example, it's going to be the same example probably a lot of you have heard me talk about many times. It's this 3 Q-trait code. So the 3 Q-trait code, the idea is that I have a Q-trait is a 3-state qubit, 0, 1, and 2. So, you know, here's a state of a Q-trait. And then the idea is that as Daniel Gottesman had been explaining, we can encode that state into a subspace of more Q-trits, where this is now going to be this is a three-dimensional subspace now of the Hilbert space of the 27-dimensional Hilbert space of 3 Q-trits. Okay, I can just tell you the subspace. So 0 tilde. So that's what's good about this example. It's, you know, simple enough. You can just write it out. So there's a GHZ kind of state. Well, they're all GHZ kind of states, but then this one is what's usually called GHZ. And then we have 0, 1, 2, 1, 2, 0, 2, 0, 1. Okay, and then 0, 2, 1, 1, 0, 2, 2, 1, 0. Okay, so that's the subspace. So this is the code subspace, right? So all the states are very entangled, right? That's convenient. It's symmetric between the three, so that's good. So we don't have to discuss all the cases separately. We just can use the symmetry to limit the number of cases we need to discuss. And the standard technology or terminology for describing this kind of situation is we say that there's a logical Q-trit, which is encoded in this subspace by these kinds of coefficients, and then there are three physical Q-trits. Okay. All right, so now why did I pick this subspace? Well, the claim is that, and I guess it can be a homework problem for the students to figure it out. So there exists a unitary transformation U12. And 1-2 means it's a unitary transformation with support only on the first two physical Q-traits, so it acts trivially on the third one. But then it has this sort of semi-magical property that if I act on one of these basis states with U12 dagger, then I just get back I1 and then chi23, where this chi is some maximally mixed state. So you know, it's for generically chosen subspace, this wouldn't exist, right? I mean, so the fact that this U12 exists is a special property of this subspace, right? And then so by staring at this and by staring at that, you can figure out what the U12 has to be. Well, the reason why this is nice is because, you know, for quantum error correcting purposes, right, is, you know, say now you have this state psi tilde, but then somehow you lose the third Q-trait. Well, that's okay. You can take the first two Q-traits which you have, and you can take your quantum computer, and you can act on them with U12 dagger, and then now you just read out the state on the first Q-trait. Okay. And then by symmetry, it's clear that there's also going to be a U13 and a U23. So then we can read out the logical. We can read out. Oh, sorry. Is there a question?
What is 3?
Yeah,
you've got 2 3s, you mean?
Where do I have 2 3s?
0, 1, 2, and now you've got 1, 2, 3.
I have 1 3 and 2 3?
No, they label the
Q-trait. They label the Q-trait. So the label here tells you which Q-traits the unitary acts on. So this was a unitary. I didn't tell you what it is, but it acts only on the first two of the physical Q-traits. And it reads the encoded state onto the first physical Q-trait. These guys would be ones, let's say U23, which I could take it to be one which acts only on qubits Q-traits 2 and 3, but it writes the state, say, onto the third Q-trait.
Right, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So that's nice. That kind of sounds like what we had here, right? Where we had these operators in the bulk, and then we could represent it on any two of these, right? And we can make it sound more like that because, you know, say that we have an operator O, which is a single Q-trait operator. So it acts like that on one Q-trait. So this is like a logical Q-trait operator. Well, I can always promote it to an operator that acts on the encoded subspace with the same matrix elements, okay? So that's easy, right? This is just some three-dimensional subspace. I can certainly come up with some operator that acts within that subspace however I want. All right. But usually this O tilde, which now implements this logical operation, it'll act non-trivially on all three of the Q-traits, right? If we just pick some stupid subspace in general, this O tilde is going to have support on all three Q-traits. But here we picked a good subspace, so we can do something clever. We can take O tilde, well, we can just have it first decode the message, and then act, let me call it O12, act with O1, and then we can re-encode the message, right? And now this is an operator with support only on the first two of the Q-traits, but which implements whichever logical operation we were interested in. And clearly, again, there will also be an O13 and O23. So any logical operator on the code subspace can be represented on any two of the Q-traits. And now that's pretty close to what we had here in ADS CFT. So far, so good. But now I want to, that so far I've probably, most of you have heard from me before, but now I want to tell you something new about this. Yeah?
The definition of O1 is that it has the matrix elements OJI.
Yeah, that's right. It has the same matrix elements. Yeah. That's right. Okay, so now I want to note one final thing. Say that rho tilde is an arbitrary state on the code subspace. You know, just some sums of outer products of these guys with some arbitrary coefficients, but you know, trace one and positive. Well, by looking at this formula, you can easily convince yourself that this must have the form where, well, I just put that same state onto the first qubit, qutrit, and then I take the outer product with chi on the second two, and then I put a U12 dagger here. Sorry, maybe that got a little cramped. I'm going to put a box around this because this is an important equation. Okay. Right. So here I just use this formula. You know, I express this state as a sum over outer products of I tildes and J tildes, and then I use this formula a couple times. Right. And then so this row one here, acting on the first qutrit, has the same matrix elements that this row tilde has acting on the code subspace. Okay. So this is kind of the encoding map, if you like, for a generic mixed state. All right, so now, good, so why did I tell you that? Well, now let's compute the entropies. Yeah.
I guess rho tilde also has non-zero probability outside the code.
No, 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 it's zero outside the code subspace. Yeah, that's important. Zero outside the code subspace. All right, so now let's compute, let's first compute S of rho tilde 3. So rho tilde 3 means I take rho tilde and I just trace out 1 and 2. Okay, so I get the reduced state on the third qutrit. Well, that's easy. So since this is the third qutrit, we can ignore the unitaries since they only act on qutrits 1 and 2. So then we just have this product state. But then we threw out 1. And so all we have left is we just cut the state chi and then we get a log 3. Okay? Hopefully that's not too mysterious, right? The U12s are unimportant, it's a product state. This chi is we have a pure state here, which we cut, and the entanglement and the entropy will be log 3, because it's a three-dimensional maximally mixed state. Similarly, if we compute rho tilde 1,2, then the U12 is not important. Now we're looking at rho tilde 1,2, so then the entropy is invariant under being conjugated by arbitrary unitary, in particular this unitary. So again, we've got a product state, and now we can just add the entropies. So we get again a log 3 from cutting chi, now we've got the other half of chi. But then now we've also got this rho 1 here. But remember, rho 1 is the same as rho tilde. It has this, it's the same matrix element, so it has the same eigenvalues. And that means it has the same entropy. So now we just get S of rho tilde. Okay? All right. Now the moment of truth. I claim that this is an example of holography. And in particular, I claim that this is this Rutaki-Inagi formula. So now let me try and explain that. So if you thought about it before, it's probably already obvious, but let's just say it out explicitly so it's clear to everyone. The idea is, this is going to be a very primitive theory of quantum gravity. The CFT is a lattice CFT, and it has three lattice points. So here, let's call them now 1, 2, and 3. Kind of like A, B, and C before, right? And these are the three physical qutrits, right? So the physical qutrits are like the CFT degrees of freedom, right? So we have three points in the boundary. Each one has a qutrit. The bulk theory is an even more primitive theory. It has one lattice point sitting in the center, and that's the logical qutrit. So we're going to call that bulk effective field theory. Okay, this is a bulk effective field theory with one point in it, and at that point you have a three-state system. Now I claim that this model of quantum gravity holography, simple though it is, has radial commutativity, subregion duality, the Rutaki-Inagi formula, effective field theory, and black holes. Uh, And most of those should already be clear, right? So subregion duality, well, so subregion duality is just this thing. Okay, right? So we found that we could any operator in the bulk which acts here, you know, so like bulk field, we saw that any bulk field living here can be represented either here or here or here, right? So this point, if you like, is in the entanglement wedge of any two of these regions, and it's not in the entanglement wedge of any one of them. The radial commutativity is kind of obvious because say I want this to commute with something here, well then I just represent it here, right? Or if I want to commute with something here, I represent it there. Okay, so it has that too. And then to see that it has root Takinagi, we just have to make one little definition. We're going to define the area operator to be log 3. It's a very fundamental area operator. Yes, so in this case, indeed, it's proportional to the identity. And you see that here, right? Because for any state in the code subspace, we always get log 3, right? And then now, moreover, you see that, so when we computed the entropy of 3, well, then there weren't any bulk degrees of freedom in the entanglement wedge, so we didn't get a bulk entropy contribution. We just got the area piece, which was the log 3. Whereas here, there was a bulk degree of freedom, and here it is. Here's its entropy. Here? Oh, yeah, sorry. So this S of rho A is like this S of rho tilde 3, right? Because subregions of the boundary are like physical cutrids, right? And then this term here is the bulk, the entropy in the entanglement wedge. So here there wasn't anything in the entanglement wedge, so we didn't get that term. But then here there was. Because here we had two boundary cutrids. You need to have two boundary cutrids to have an interesting entanglement wedge here. No, because this is true as I wrote it.
For the trace of rho alphabet, right?
Here? No, this is the log 3. So the area operator is log 3 times the identity. So then this is just log 3, and then similarly here. Okay. So I get a log 3 in both terms.
Okay, so it's log 3 equals log 3 plus 0?
No, this is So for the top one, it's log 3 equals log 3 plus 0. That's right, yeah. For the bottom one, it's something non-trivial equals log 3 plus something non-trivial, right? And so it depends on the state, right? Like, so you pick the state here, and then it. Okay. All right, so that's three of the things I said. It also has bulk effective field theory. I already said that because it has the cutrid here. So the only other thing I have to tell you is the black holes. But that's easy too. So remember, this is only 3 out of the 27 states in the Hilbert space, right? So we've got to make something of the other 24. So the other 24 are the microstates of a big black hole that has eaten our one point, right? And that's the complete Hilbert space of this quantum gravity model. There are a few states where there's not a big black hole, and then it has a field there. And then when there is a big black hole, well, you lost the field, but now you have the microstates of the black hole, and that's the other 24 states. All right. Okay, so I claim this is holography in a nutshell, right? This is holography you can explain to your undergraduates. All right. So now let me just, before I go on to the general theory, because this is just some simple example, let me just emphasize again the origin of the area term. So in the way I set it up here, it's the orthogonal complement of the code subspace is the black hole. But it's still physical. It's part of the theory. I mean, you know, the state, you know, because all CFT states are physical. I'm going to explain that later. To do that, I need more than one bulk point. But well, we'll see how we do on time. But if I have time in the end of the talk, I promise I'll show you how it holds in all the states. Yes. Well, you can kind of think about it however you want. So, I mean, the field has three things. When you have the black hole, the fields are all gone, right? Because there's only one point. So it's either inside the black hole or not inside the black hole, right? So if it's inside the black hole, then we forget about that point. And now you just have 24 states. So then the entropy of the black hole is log of 24. OK.
Sorry,
Well, yeah, but that's the funny thing about this theory is there's only one point. I mean, the reason why you think that is because usually there are fields outside the black hole. I mean, we'll see that in the, I mean, this is just some silly example, right? But, I mean, I wanted to go through it so that we get all the ideas straight in a sort of very straight, simple thing. But now let me just, again, emphasize where the area term came from, right? So the area term in this formula came from the fact that this chi had entanglement in it, right? So, like, had this chi been a product state, we wouldn't have had the log threes here. We would have just had entropy equals entropy, right? So let's just think about what this chi is doing, right? This chi is serving two purposes. So one is just bookkeeping. We need this chi here because the Hilbert space is 27-dimensional, so we have to somehow turn three states into 27, right? So we need to put something here. But moreover, this is the something which we hold fixed, right? This is the information which is held fixed throughout the code subspace, right? That's the source of the log three. And moreover, the entanglement in chi is very important for the functioning of the code, right? Because say chi were a product state. Well, if chi were a product state, then this equation would mean that the third qubit was just dispensable, right? The third qubit was just useless. If chi were a product state, right, then we could just throw it out because there's a U12 here. And so then you would never be in a situation where, for example, there was information that wasn't in 1 or 2 separately, but was in 1, 3, or 2, 3, right? So the redundancy of the code, you know, the ability to do this subregion decomposition in different ways, comes from the entanglement in the state chi, and it's that very entanglement which is responsible for the area term. Okay? That's the sort of microscopic interpretation of the area term, or CFT interpretation of the area term. Okay. All right, so that's all I wanted to say about the example. So now we're going to do some mathematics and try and generalize this. So any other questions about the example? Let's have them now. Okay. So now we're going to take a detour. It's a detour which I think should be fun, and for some of you, I hope it'll be fun. But it's going to be a mathematical detour. So we're going to discuss von Neumann algebras, and I'm going to tell you a series of facts about von Neumann algebras. So I'm sorry if it seems like that's a cruel thing to do. To make it less cruel, I'm only going to discuss von Neumann algebras on finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So that should at least, that takes care of the worst of the subject. But it turns out that this language is really going to be essential to understand the final interpretation of the Rutaki-Nagy formula that we're going to come up with. So just bear with me. So this is so math class for 10 minutes. Okay, operator algebras. And I should say, I mean, you know, to a first approximation, everything I know about this subject I learned from Horacio. So I don't know if he's in here somewhere, but he's I think probably for a lot of us the person who made this an interesting subject. So say that H is a finite dimensional Hilbert space. Let's just write space. Okay, Hilbert space, complex Hilbert space. Just to establish some notation, and then L, script L of H, is the set of linear operators on H. Okay, so I learned from Greg Moore I'm supposed to call that the endomorphisms of H. I think I'll just call it linear operators. So definition. So M, a subset of L of H, is a von Neumann if. So there are four things that need to be true. So one is that we need all the multiples of the identity to be in M. And then we need it to be closed under dagger plus and times. Okay, so that's not too mysterious. Seems like a nice set of restrictions to put on the subspace. Okay. Now, what? It contains all the scalar multiples of the identity operator, including complex multiples. Okay, let me put VNA here. So let me give an example, because this is an example that it's good to keep in mind. Okay, so example, say that H is just a tensor product of H big A times H big A bar. Okay, so you could think of that like the CFT or something if you wanted, but like, let's just think of it as some tensor product Hilbert space. And then can define, I wanted to make two more definitions and then I forgot. So sorry, let me just quickly define up here. So M prime, which is called the commutant of M, is the set of things in L of H which commute with everything in M. Okay, that's called the commutant. Right? Makes sense. The commutant is all the things that commute with M. And then the center is the intersection of M and its commutant. So it's the set of all the things in the algebra that commute with everything in the algebra. Okay, good. Now, yes, and they're both von Neumann algebras. Yeah, homework problem. That's an easy one. So these are both von Neumann algebras, which are associated to the one that we started with. Okay, good. So now let's do the example. All right. So the example is that we have a tensor product Hilbert space, and then M, I'm just going to take to be the set of all the operators on HA, tensored with the identity on A bar. Okay, that's a pretty easy von Neumann algebra to come up with. So von Neumann algebra like this is called a factor. Not too surprising. So we can compute the commutant, right? So that, unsurprisingly, is just all the operators on the other factor. And then the center is just all the multiples of the identity. So that's the sort of simplest kind of von Neumann algebra. And again, then we say M is a factor. Okay. Now here's the big theorem. So all M are direct sums of factors. Okay, so this is the classification of von Neumann algebras in finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So let's just expand out a little what that means. So the idea is for any von Neumann algebra M, the Hilbert space is going to have a direct sum structure where this is like a block decomposition. And then block by block, we'll have a factorization into H A sub alpha times H A bar sub alpha. And then M, the algebra, is just, well, it's going to be block diagonal in this decomposition. It's just within each block, it's just going to be all the operators acting on the first factor, tensor the identity on the other factor. All right. So this should not be obvious. So it was so non-obvious that I felt burdened to put a proof of it into the appendix of my paper so that anyone else who wants to know it doesn't have to suffer through the infinite dimensional literature to extract it like I did. The plus dot 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 was from the previous equation. Let me write up here. So then the commutant, not complement, commutant, is now the same kind of thing, except now we've got the identity on the first factor, tensored with all the operators on the other factor. The center is just a sum with arbitrary coefficients over the projection operators onto each of the blocks in this decomposition, right? So for each alpha, we can have a projection operator onto that block. So the center, if you like, is block by block proportional to the identity. So you know, maybe to make this a little more intuitive, right? So here are the blocks. All right, and then everything in M prime and ZM is block diagonal according to this decomposition. The things that are in M are things which act, you know, arbitrarily on, so and then each of these factorizes, and the things in M act on one factor and the things in M prime act on the other factor. We can adjust them all independently as we go down the blocks. And then the center is just, well, in each block we have the identity times something, but then it can be a different something in each of the different blocks. Okay. All right, now why did I inflict that on you? Well, the reason is because there's a definition of entropy for algebras, which is more general than the von Neumann definition of entropy, and we're going to need it. We're going to need the generalization to understand the Ruta-Kanagi formula. What did I do? Here? Oh, that's an H, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's just, you know. I got a C in handwriting when I was in second grade, you know. Oh, man. Sorry, teacher. So this equation says that M, the algebra, is equal to the direct sum over alpha. So here I'm abusing notation. What this means is that it's block diagonal. Okay, and I'm telling you how it acts in each of the blocks. And then it's an arbitrary operator on the first factor of the block times the identity on the second factor of the block. Okay? Well, P alpha, that just means the operator which is the identity here and is zero everywhere else. So that just gives you a way of getting a multiple of the identity in each factor, in each block. Okay, good. So now let's just quickly understand how the entropy works, and then we can get back to physics. So now we want to define the entropy of rho, a state, any state, on M, the algebra. And to understand how it's going to reduce to the usual von Neumann algebra, the idea is that in the special case where M is a factor, so that the Hilbert space is just the tensor product of two things, then we want our definition to reduce to just the usual thing, where you take rho, you take the partial trace over this, and then you do minus trace of rho log rho on that. Okay, that's the thing we're going to try to extend to the case where the algebra is not a factor. Okay, so what do we do? Well, any rho, we can of course look at it in this block basis that we get from this decomposition. And the first thing to notice is that all of the off-diagonal blocks don't contribute to the expectation values of anything in the algebra, right? Because stuff in the algebra is block diagonal. So when you compute trace of this times something like that, then only the diagonal blocks matter. All right. So we're just not going to discuss the off-diagonal blocks at all. The diagonal blocks, we're going to decompose like this. So I'll write P1, rho A1, A1 bar, P2, rho A2, A2 bar. So far I'm just giving names. But then the idea is that I know that the trace of the whole thing is 1. So then I choose P sub alpha such that the trace of rho A alpha A bar alpha equals 1. So, right, because these blocks by themselves won't have trace 1. Their sum, the sum of their traces is 1. So I just pull that out into these probability factors, P1, P2, et cetera. And then, right, and then when I do that, the sum over the alphas, P alpha, is going to be 1. So this is like saying that you, you know, there's a classical probability that you find yourself in any particular block, and then once you're in that block, then you've got a density matrix. Oh, well, yeah, they exist, but they don't contribute to the expectation values of anything in the algebra. So I mean, they're there, but I just chose not to give them a name. I'm going to construct the entropy only out of these. That's why.
So that was the decision.
Yeah. So you can try it. So I'm going to give the definition in kind of a very sort of just here's the formula kind of way. You can also try and motivate it. I do some of that in my appendix, but that would probably take us a little bit further. But it has the same kind of interpretation, right? So you, roughly speaking, you have a subalgebra, so that's like the information you have access to, and then you want to know, like, if you do a complete projective measurement, how much information do you acquire? And so when you think about it that way, you'll come up with this formula. But I'm just going to tell you the formula. Sorry, where? Choose. Oh, yeah, choose. So I'm just, I'm taking, so this, here I just have some matrix, okay, and the trace of this matrix is a number that I'll call P1, okay? And then I just choose to pull that factor out and define a new symbol, which is row A1, A bar 1, which has trace 1. So I'm just pulling the trace out piece by piece. I'm not changing the state or anything. I'm just picking some variables. Well, I haven't defined anything yet. I'm going to define the entropy, but I haven't written down the formula yet. It's almost that, but then I said, but then you remove all the extra entropies coming from the maximally mixed factors. Because I want it to reduce to this, right? So I mean, in the factor case, right, what you would do is that state you just mentioned would be the partial trace here times the identity here. But then if I compute the entropy, there will be two parts. There will be the von Neumann entropy here, and then there will be a part which is the log of the dimensionality here. So the definition I'm given is just throwing that out, that part out. And other than that, it's what you said. No, they aren't, but the ones in the commutant are. Yeah. The ones in the commutant do. So, I mean, they're there. Okay, so good. So now at last, let's define the entropy. So now S of rho and M has a simple formula. So there's a classical piece that comes from these P alphas, which is just sort of the Shannon entropy of which super selection sector you're in, if you want to use words like that. And then there's a quantum piece where you just average over P alpha the entropy of A alpha, rho A alpha. So to be clear here, this rho A alpha is the partial trace over A bar alpha of rho A alpha bar. Okay. Not quite, right? Because you have to deal with these identity factors that we were discussing. So, I mean, this is not. So, if you set all So, if you set all of these to zero and then you computed trace of rho log rho, you wouldn't get this. You would get this plus some factor, which is like the sum over the log of the dimensionalities of the complementary factors. And so you have to get rid of those. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the extra step. And so, if you look in the appendix, there's some elegant way of saying that where it looks a little less arbitrary. But I think let's just do it this way. Okay. So note, indeed, that if M is a factor, that means that there's only one block, right? So then there's a P alpha, which is 1. So this term is 0. And then there's no sum over alpha. So then this one is 1. And then we get back to the von Neumann. We get back to the von Neumann entropy. Okay. So that's basically all I wanted to say. So now just to get us oriented again for holography, the idea is that we pick some boundary subregion A and we draw its entanglement wedge here. And then M is like the algebra of bulk operators in the entanglement wedge of A. And M prime is like the algebra of bulk operators in the entanglement wedge of A bar. Okay, so that just to get oriented. All right. All right. So now let's have some fun. So now I'm going to present a theorem which describes in a very general way what happened in the 3-qutrit code. All right, theorem. All right, so say that we have a Hilbert space which factorizes HA times HA bar. And then we have a code subspace, just some subspace. We'll just call it the code subspace, but it's some subspace, which is contained in HA tensor HA bar. And finally, say that M is a von Neumann algebra on H code. All right? So in the ADS-CFT application, right, the code subspace is like, roughly speaking, the states where effective field theory is valid. That's like the easiest way of thinking about it, although we'll see some generalizations later. And then this M is like this, right? It's like we could think of it as being the algebra and the entanglement wedge. But I mean, so far we're just doing linear algebra. Okay. So then I claim the following are equivalent. All right. So, okay. And so each of these by itself, it could be true, it could not be true. The theorem is that they're all equivalent. Okay, so for all operators in M, right, so all, if you like, operators in the bulk entanglement wedge, if you want to use that language, but just operators in the algebra. And for all operators O tilde prime in M prime, the commutant of M, then there exists operators OA on HA and OA bar, I'll call it prime, on HA bar, such that for all states in the code subspace, we have that OA acting on psi tilde equals O tilde acting on psi tilde. OA dagger psi tilde is O tilde dagger acting on psi tilde. And the complementary thing and then finally, OA bar prime acting on psi tilde equals O tilde prime dagger, acting on psi tilde. So this is subregion duality, right? This is saying that operators in the algebra M, which you can think of as being like the bulk things here, have representations here, right? So this OA is like the boundary representation of the operator in the algebra on A, and OA bar prime is the boundary representation of some operator in the commutant on the other factor of the boundary theory. So this is saying that the subregion duality works both ways, right? So this goes here, this goes there. Yeah? Is missing a, oh yeah, you're right, thank you. I never know to put the prime first or the dagger first. I think it should be prime dagger, right? Okay. All right, okay, so that's one thing. Now we're gonna say that this is a thing that we think should be true, bulk reconstruction in the entanglement wedge.
So having chosen
an A,
is 1-to-1 between the bulk and
the operator? No, so there could be many more operators on A than there are operators in the algebra M. So it's one way, it's just saying for the operators that are in the algebra, they can be represented on OA. I mean, you could have operators that create huge black holes or something sitting in A, right? Yeah. Okay. So far I haven't said anything. I wrote a condition. So to have a theorem, I need at least two conditions. We'll have three actually. Okay. Condition two. Condition two says there exists an operator LA, which is in the center of M, such that for all rho tilde on H code, we have that S of rho tilde A is trace of rho tilde LA plus, and now here we go, the entropy of the state rho tilde on the algebra M. And similarly, if we look at the entropy of rho on a bar, the complementary boundary region, then we get again the expectation value of something which we might as well call the area operator, and then the algebraic entropy of the commutant on the same state. All right? So this is the Rutaki-Nagi formula, you see? LA is the area operator. Well, this is saying the boundary entropy is equal to the area operator plus area plus the bulk entropy. And similarly for the other direction, for the other wedge. So already we learned something interesting. We learned that Ru Takenagi is sort of if and only if subregion duality. And now let me mention one more thing. So this one I'll just mention. Oh, sorry, a question?
So in the first equation you have M and the second M prime, but shouldn't the bulk entropy be the same?
No, because what's going on in here could be different than what's going on in here. Right?
It's an entanglement between the, isn't it an entanglement between the two sides of the bulk?
No, not necessarily. It could be in a mixed state. It could be in a mixed state, yeah. Incidentally, just to harass one of the other speakers, I categorically oppose the use of the term entanglement entropy, and I will do my best never to use it unless the state is pure. What? Well, yeah, so apparently it's in the center, so that must be the case, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to discuss that in a sec, so just hold that thought, yeah. Yeah, let me say the last thing in the theorem. So I'll just mention this. So people mentioned relative entropy several times in the talks. So the third thing is for all rho tilde and sigma tilde on H code, we have that the relative entropy on the subregion A is given by the algebraic relative entropy on the algebra M, and similarly for the complement. So I didn't actually define the algebraic relative entropy, but trust me, it's more or less, I mean, the formula is more or less like that. Similar kinds of ideas lead you to that. When? Oh, sorry, there should be tildes everywhere. Okay, and so that tells us that this is also equivalent to JLMS, where this is Jaffaris, Lukowitz, who is here, Maldacena, and Sue, who is also here somewhere. So this is saying that the equivalence of these relative entropies is equivalent to Rutaki-Nagi, is equivalent to subregion duality. And so I should say, by the way, that I had a paper with Shi and Aaron earlier this year, which I guess showed that 2 implies 3 implies 1. So this is kind of in the special case where the algebra is a factor. So this is a sort of extension of that, but then showing that you can run the arrow the other way also. Yes. Yeah, well, I'm going to discuss that. I mean, that's the whole, right. So yeah, actually, let's talk about that now. So I want to emphasize that that the fact that we generalize to operator algebras is kind of essential here, because say that M were a factor, right? So say that we interpreted the code subspace as factorizing into sort of the bulk degrees of freedom here and the bulk degrees of freedom there. Well, we saw that for a factor algebra, the center is trivial. It consists only of multiples of the identity. But here we saw that the area operator has to be in the center. So if the area operator is in the center, and we want the area operator to be non-trivial, which surely we want, in quantum gravity, right? We should be allowed to have states where the area is different in different states. Then we need this generalization. We need to talk about entropies of algebras and not just entropies of factors. Okay. Now, one thing, well, maybe I'll just briefly comment also. From the bulk side, you can also argue that the area operator has to be in the center by keeping track of where the gravitational dressings go of operators in the two wedges, but I think I won't try and explain that now. But it's not a surprise from the bulk point of view that the area is in the center. Yes? Yeah, but I don't want to do that. I want to allow certainly at least in perturbation theory, the area operator is going to fluctuate. So even around a fixed geometry at higher orders in G Newton, we're going to need this. And then it's nicer if we can include superpositions. Yeah. Oh, yeah, so I was going to discuss that later. I mean, so is Rob here somewhere? I don't know. I mean, the next thing starts when? At 2:30?
Keep going.
Can I just keep going? I mean, yeah. And if people are bored, they can, because we now have the theorem, and now we want to enjoy the theorem, right? We want to now learn stuff, right? So. Yeah. Are you worried about homology?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to discuss that a lot. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, yeah, right. So, but I now want to say, so one thing which, by stating the theorem this way, I didn't really explain, is that the theorem is actually constructive for this L sub A. So it tells you what the area operator is. So we already saw that in the 3-qutrid code, right? We had that state chi. And we saw that the area came from cutting the state chi, right? It came from the entanglement in the state chi. I don't un-erase this yet. Keep that.
In the holographic case, the closed subspace is the space that has all geometric holographic holes that don't mean black holes.
So, no, there are lots of different things. We're going to consider lots of code subspaces in a sec. So the most conservative code subspace is the one where you just say consider states whose energy is less than n to the 1/4 and then its image under the conformal group, and then that's the states with no black holes. But we should certainly at least be able to deal with things like the solar system, right? I mean, so and I'm going to argue that this formula works, including both the solar system and the vacuum. We're going to talk about that too. Although, well, we'll see how much we're going to talk about, but we could talk about that. We might talk about that. Okay. So let me just say a little bit about the interpretation of this area operator, L sub A. So for simplicity, I'm gonna tell it to you in the case where we take it to factorize. So it's still gonna be proportional to the area, and just proportional to the identity. The story doesn't change much if we then include the center, but just to give everyone a picture to carry around in the back of the head, it's easier to first think about the factorized case. So say that H code itself factorizes into H little a and H little a bar, and then we're just considering the algebra on this factor. So then somewhere in the middle of proving this theorem, what you find is that the states in the code subspace are prepared in the following way. So there's a state chi, fixed state, part of which is in A, and part of which is in A bar. There's the degrees of freedom in the entanglement wedge of A, which we feed in here, and which is also, think of that as part of A. There's the degrees of freedom in the entanglement wedge of A bar, which we can put into the other part of A bar. And then we're going to act with some unitaries, UA and UA bar, and that's going to prepare the code subspace in the CFT. So this is the holographic encoding map, right? We start with some very high energy state in the CFT. It's a product state. We just have the degrees of freedom in the bulk on some piece of A, in the bulk entanglement wedge of A and some piece of A. We have the degrees of freedom of the bulk entanglement wedge of A bar on some piece of A bar, and then we time some fixed state. Okay, so that's some horrible state. Yeah, that's right. So half of chi is in A. I called it A2. Yeah, so here I said that HA is HA1 times HA2, and HA bar is HA1 bar times HA2 bar. So I just split it in some arbitrary way. And then chi lives on these two, and then I feed in the bulk information on these two. Yeah, so small a is a factor of the code subspace. So it's like it's isomorphic to like the bulk effective field theory, Hilbert space. And then I hit it with these encoding unitaries to prepare the actual state in the CFT, which we think is dual to this bulk system. Okay. So you can show that specifying to a factor, you can show that if the subregion duality is true, then the code subspace always has this structure. But then now you see it's just the same as the 3-qutrit code, right? So this UA is like the U12 I had before. And this UA bar, well, there it was one because there was only one. Because there was just the chi there. There wasn't anything in the entanglement wedge of A bar. So then this means that the area operator is just the entropy of the trace, say, over A2 bar of chi chi. Okay. So again, the area operator is coming from the entanglement in the state chi, from cutting the state chi. Okay. And then again, remember that the entanglement in chi is necessary to have a good code subspace, right? So the fact that chi is fixed is necessary to have a subspace at all. And the fact that chi is very entangled is necessary for the subregion duality to be sort of stable under changing your choice of A and A bar, right? So that the same thing can be reconstructed in different ways. But now we see quite generally that that's the source of the area, of the area piece.
In your previous discussion, A1 and A2 appear when you write a M and chi and chi as factors.
Yeah, sorry, those are different. So those are different. Yeah. So remember the algebra is acting on the code subspace. So the A's that were capital before now would be little in this notation were I to use it. And that was a decomposition of the code subspace in a direct sum. The capital A's here are the boundary regions. So this is a cut that happens in the CFT subregion. It's not something that happens in the book. Oh, we just pick them. It doesn't matter. I mean, you see there are unitaries here, so by changing the unitaries, we can change which ones we pick. So it doesn't matter. Yeah. Well, I'd rather not do that because I want states in the bulk to be states in the CFT. You know, pure states in the bulk to be pure states in the CFT. Yeah. That's right. So no, I'd rather not have that. I mean, also the code would get worse if you did that, right? I think it would. Well, I'm not totally sure, but I think it would get worse. So there's the area operator, right? Because again, you know, I compute the entropy up here. I can forget about the U. Now we just have a product state, and so we get half of the chi. That's the area, and then we get the entropy from the bulk here. Yeah, that's right. So in this case, it's a number, and it's proportional to the identity operator on the code subspace. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so now let me just very briefly comment because Matt gave a talk about threads last week.
Sorry, did you say that
Yeah. So remember, but I said I was gonna restrict to the case for drawing this picture where M is a factor. So what happens when M has non-trivial center is that there's a set of chi's labeled by alpha. And then the area operator now becomes a non-trivial operator where we sum over the alphas. We compute this for each chi alpha, and then we put a p alpha. And now it's an element of the center. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, just then it's harder to draw the pictures. Yeah. So these are apparently going to be different geometries because they have different areas. That's right. Okay. Now let me just briefly comment about the threads. So I didn't want to say too much about it because I have other things to say. But if you look at this picture, right, what is really going on here? Well, if we say we only care about the area piece, right? So we now want to forget about the bulk piece for a second. So then all the entropy is just coming from this state chi, right? And then the amount of entanglement in this chi is kind of like the information flux through the circuit, which we can think of as going like that. So that's basically the same as the threads that Matt was talking about, right? Like here we have some information that we're running into from region A, but then we have to get through this bottleneck, which is this state chi. And so the entanglement entropy in chi sets the sort of flux of this channel, right? So you can think of this as like a quantum channel, if you like. And the sort of amount of stuff you can send through it is controlled by the amount of entanglement in chi. So then I would say that's kind of like an information theoretic version of the threads that Matt was talking about on Monday. All right. Okay, so now let me talk about two other applications of this. Yeah. No, that's right. So at higher orders in Jinuden, good. So this won't quite apply correctly because fluctuations can move the extremal surface around. So what happens is you have an entanglement wedge here and an entanglement wedge here, and then you sort of have no man's land in here, where sort of things are sometimes go one way and sometimes go the other way. The thickness of this is the Planck length. So I'm essentially just staying away from that, but I was doing it sort of not explicitly in the formulas. And so to do it explicitly in the formulas, you'd have to modify things a bit. So actually, in the paper with Shi and Aaron, we did some of that. But I mean, yeah, I guess you guys are going to do it better, right? So. I think those are separate issues, right? So that's one way of trying to get to the back reaction, but I think you can just also just have it with large superpositions of order one coefficients. We're going to do that in a sec. So many things to say, so little time. Okay, let me just say quickly in words. So this center is really associated to the fact that there are gauge fields in the bulk. Right, like if you have, we already had a talk earlier this week about how the Hilbert space doesn't factorize in the presence of gauge constraints. And indeed, these elements of the center here are the same things which Wall and Donnelly have called edge modes, and which Hawking, Perry, and Strominger half of the time call soft hair. So these elements of the center have shown up in other recent things. They seem interesting. There's some connection to a paper I wrote last year also, but let me not try and explain it now. So instead, let me get to these questions of linearity and homology, because that's what everyone is asking about. Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah, right, in the area operator, it's kind of like the Noether charge of the gravitational field, right? Whereas like with Wall and Donnelly, they were interested in the electric flux through the horizon, which is like the Noether charge of the electromagnetic field. So it's the same kinds of things. So in the bulk, that's how you can think about the center. Now let me just discuss linearity. Okay. So indeed, let's say that we now want to consider a state which is an admixture of states with different geometries. All right. So this was studied recently in a nice paper by Shi and Ahmed and Brian Swingle. They were worried exactly about this question of the linearity of the Rutakyanagi formula. So just in the CFT, we can compute this entropy. Um, And so we can of course restrict to a region A, but if we like. And then what they pointed out is that this has sort of two interesting terms. So when the log hits the lambda, you get this thing which is called entropy of mixing. And then you get an average over the entropies of each of these guys separately. And what they pointed out was that, well, and also I should say Suvrat Raju and Kyriakos Papadimos also discussed this kind of thing earlier in another paper where they also wrote down this term. So this entropy of mixing is nonlinear in the superposition, right? So this is sort of one illustration of the nonlinearity of the entropy, right? So we take a linear admixture of states, and then here we get a term which is linear, but then here we have this nonlinear term, right? And then so they were asking, well, how can that come from the expectation value of a linear operator? Okay. Yeah, because they correspond to different geometries. We can say they're, the geometries peak to different points. So they may have small overlaps, which I'm ignoring. But yeah. Yeah, so there's plus e to the minus n squareds. Those are everywhere. I've been neglecting those all the time. Okay. So now let's try to apply Ru Takayanagi to both sides of this. If we just include the area term, it's not going to work, right? And so the comment, so these previous papers, what they said is, oh, well, that's okay. This is order one, so don't worry about it. But what I claim is that something better, so that if we use the right Ru Takayanagi formula, including the bulk term, then we're actually going to reproduce this. So it's not a thing to ignore. It's a thing to understand and explain. No, this is order one number of geometries. Yeah, we'll discuss that in a sec, but let's start out small. So on the right-hand side, right, we're going to get a sum over I, lambda I, trace of rho tilde I times the area operator, right? So that's, but then we'll also get S bulk of this sum on I, lambda I, rho I, right? And then we want to see if we can get the right-hand side by putting the Ru Takayanagi formula here. So now let me shuffle stuff around a little. So from here, we again get the linear piece from the area operator. Right, and that clearly matches between both sides. But now we also get plus an average over these lambda i's, S of rho I tilde, from the bulk entropy. How shall I say this? What am I writing here? And then we also get the entropy of mixing. All right, so that shouldn't be too mysterious. So I plugged in the Ru Takayanagi formula here, including the bulk entropy and the area term. Okay, so now these match between both sides, so we can forget about them. And then the point is that, well, this here is the algebraic entropy, right? And remember that the algebraic entropy has two contributions. And here are the two contributions. And remember that these are states with different values for the area, so they're in different blocks of the center, right? So then these p's are just a subset of these p's. And so then this term in the bulk entropy here reproduces the entropy of mixing, and that term reproduces this term. So we see that the formula is correct, including the superpositions of different geometries. Yes? No. It's the bulk. This area operator acts on the code. So these are in the code subspace, and these are in the code subspace. But you're worried about these exponential tails again? The area operator, my area operator acts within the code subspace. It's a subset, but. My bulk. No, I'm defining the entanglement wedge in a gauge invariant way. So the operators make sense in a Hilbert space that includes different geometries. Yeah, and I mean that's the whole point, right? Like that's what this is, right? This is the contribution to the entropy from different geometries, and we see here we got it from the CFT, from the entropy of mixing. Okay, I don't want to say that this is a complete demonstration that it always works. This is an example of a case where you can do an admixture of different geometries and the formula is true. Okay. Yes? You have to think harder. I mean, this is already an admixture of different geometries. So that's already something which you might have thought would get you into trouble, right? Yes? Yeah. Well, I was about to talk about quantum black holes. Now, let me first say, I haven't discussed black holes at all, so don't ask about them yet. Let me say 2 minutes about them, and then we'll stop, and then if it's... Maybe, but let me just say what happens for the black holes. I think it'll be more clear. Yeah, yeah. The code subspace includes different geometries. This is an admixture of different geometries. I said that. This is like the entropy of mixing over different geometries, but it's the entropy of mixing over the center, right? But I mean, it's the same thing we found here. So, okay, let me just say 2 more minutes, sorry, just because I want to say it, and then you can ask me about it if it's not totally clear. So the last thing I'm going to do is black hole. So now let's consider a code subspace where we're allowed to have a black hole here. So far our code subspaces haven't had black holes. How shall I say? So there's some state of the black. And let's just consider the region to be the whole boundary, for simplicity. So now let's first consider the case where the black hole is in a pure state. So then. The Ruth Takanagi formula tells us that SA equals zero. And so that suggests that, well, we better have LA equal to zero, which means that the minimal surface is trivial. And that's OK, right? I mean, we took the whole boundary, so the whole boundary doesn't have a boundary. So the minimal surface is allowed to be the empty set. But then what was pointed out by Shi and Ahmed and Brian is that now if we then take this same black hole, but now we put it in the thermal state, its entropy is not zero. And the conventional explanation of that is that you use the homology constraint in the Ruth Takanagi formula to pick up a piece which is wrapping the horizon, okay? But now it's clear that if we include all the microstates in the code subspace at once, and if the area operator is zero on all of the microstates because they're pure, then it's gonna be zero on the admixture too, right? So if we think that some formula like this is true throughout the code subspace, including all the microstates, then this area operator cannot include the homology constraint. Okay. Nonetheless, I claim that this formula can still be true. In fact, in the tensor networks, like the happy tensor networks, you can prove that it's true. But the reason that it's true is that the black hole entropy actually contributes to this term. So let me just close with that. So in the tensor networks, right, what happens is you have legs coming out of the black hole. You have legs coming out of the bulk, which correspond to the bulk fields. The tensor network gives you an isometry from both of them to the boundary. And then if you feed a state into all the legs and you compute the entropy, then what you find is, well, this area term is zero. You're not cutting any links. But the black hole entropy contributes here. So you can check that in many more cases. So you know, one that I like is now you have the black hole, but then now you take A to be only half the boundary. And now there is some area term coming from here. There's some bulk entropy, which is both coming from the horizon here and from the effective field theory degrees of freedom here. And it illustrates the general principle, which is that in a fixed code subspace, the meanings of these terms are separately clear, right? Like this one we interpreted in terms of the chi. But as you make the code subspace bigger, so you include more UV degrees of freedom in the theory, stuff can move. So this won't change, right? It's the same state. But stuff can move from this term to this term. And this is actually something you expect, right? Under renormalization group flow, we always say that stuff can be passed back and forth between the two. And here, you can see it, for example, in the tensor networks, you can see it rigorously. And the limit that you allow the black hole to grow, you just move everything from here to here. The area term is gone, and entropy equals entropy, which, after all, is, you know, what should be true if you're looking at the entire theory, including all the degrees of freedom. So I claim that pretty much all the states in the Hilbert space, including whatever black holes you want, as long as you fix the code subspace to include, you know, whichever ones you want, then this formula will be true for some choice of which things are here and which things are there. All right, I'm done. Thanks.